From Cherry Hill Publishing, First and Only, by Peter Flannery, read by R.D. Watson. Prologue. Newspaper cutting, 14 years ago. Torture. Police have confirmed that the man's body, found earlier this week in Didsbury, Manchester, showed signs of torture. They have refused to comment on the nature of the injuries and defended their lack of progress in finding the killer. The lighting in the church was pleasantly subdued. Flames flickered through sconces of red glass, and the still air carried the familiar smells of furniture polish, burning candles, incense, and stone. It was time for evening confession in the parish church of St. Joseph's. Two tradesmen worked quietly from a tower of scaffolding, fitting new lights above the statue of the Sacred Heart, but apart from them, the church was almost empty. Just two people waited silently in the pews. One was a woman in her 60s, with her faded blue raincoat and dull grey hair. The other was an 8-year-old boy, who sat in the pew with his head bowed and his hands twisting in his lap. His name was Simon, and he was terrified. Every week, he came to evening confession. Not to confess his sins, but just to speak to Father Kavanagh, the gentlest, most understanding man he'd ever known. He enjoyed the game of pretending they did not know each other, and the fact that the priest was bound by a sacred oath never to reveal a word of what was told to him. But tonight was different. Tonight, something was going to happen, something from his dreams, from his nightmares. The church appeared serene and safe. There was nothing to portend the presence of evil, but somehow Simon knew. Somehow, Simon always knew. To the right of the pews were the two doors of the confessional, each leading to a small rectangular room, and joined by a pierced screen of polished brass. Simon glanced up as the light above the penitent's door went out, and an elderly man emerged, clutching a flat cap and a walking stick carved in the likeness of a Jack Russell Terrier. He gave Simon a smile and a conspiratorial wink before making his way to the doors at the back of the church. The light above the other door remained lit, indicating that the priest was still in residence. The grey-haired woman turned to look at Simon, but he bowed his head and the woman gave a weary sigh before rising from her pew. As the woman disappeared into the confessional, Simon looked up at the workmen. Except for them, the church was now empty. There was no one else waiting to see Father Kavanagh. He drew a breath. Maybe he was wrong. Maybe the old priest will be all right after all. He glanced eagerly at the confessional light. The grey-haired woman would not take long. She never did. He was edging towards the end of the pew when he froze. He felt a prickling sensation across the back of his neck, and an unpleasant chill surged through his body. Someone had entered the church behind him, and Simon knew that his fears were true. His small hands gripped the pew as the stranger came closer, until he could hear their heavy footfalls on the brown ceramic floor tiles. And there was something else, a noise, a confusion of whispers that sounded almost like a voice, or many voices. Simon did not know if the whispers were coming from the stranger, or just echoing within the confines of his own head. He tried not to listen. He did not like the voices. The stranger was almost level with him when the confessional door opened, and the grey-haired woman stepped out into the aisle. From the corner of his eye, Simon saw the woman check herself at the sight of the stranger. He noticed how she flattened herself against the wall to let the stranger pass. Simon's eyes flitted fearfully to the side. He saw a tall youth with long black hair falling unkempt about his face. His posture was hunched and brooding, but his broad shoulders spoke of the powerful man he would soon become. Without hesitation, the stranger opened the door to the penitent's confessional and disappeared inside. Simon glanced at the grey-haired woman, who gave him a brief look of concern before hurrying away, the harsh click of her heels receding until she left the church and the main door closed with a soft, percussive boom. An ominous silence descended in which Simon could hear his own shallow breathing. He could just hear the tradesmen atop the scaffolding talking in low, respectful voices. And now he could hear the stranger's voice, harsh, unpleasant, and made all the more sinister by the incessant presence of the whispers. Whispers that were almost words. He did not want to hear it, but he could not shut it out.
"Forgive me, Father, for I have sinned," the stranger said. "But then I told you I was going to, didn't I?"
The stranger snorted in response to some reaction from the priest.
"Yeah, your lost sheep has returned to confess his sins."
There was a pause, and Simon could sense Father Kavanagh's shock and fear.
"So who needs a confessor now, priest? He who committed the sin, or he who let it happen?"
The stranger spoke in a mocking tone, and in the background the voices whispered with dark malevolence. Father Kavanagh did not answer, but somehow Simon could sense his breathing, heavy and laboured, and his heart thumping, thumping. Simon wrapped his arms around his chest as his own body began to mirror the old priest's anxiety.
"You knew I'd do it, didn't you, Father?"
Still, Father Kavanagh said nothing, and Simon winced, hunching forward and struggling to breathe through the pain that was crushing his chest.
"What's the matter, priest? Taken a vow of silence?"
Fighting against the pain, Simon raised his head, looking up at the workmen who were oblivious to what was happening.
"He wasn't silent when I put him to the torment."
Simon's eyes grew wide. He did not know what the stranger was talking about, but he knew that something terrible had happened, that the stranger had done something terrible. He was about to call to the workman when he heard a heavy thudding sound coming from the priest's confessional. Before he knew what he was doing, Simon dashed across the aisle and pulled open the priest's door. Father Kavanagh had slipped from his chair and was slumped in the corner of the small room, his hands knotted in his cassock, clutching at his chest.
"Stop it," said Simon. "Stop it. You're hurting him." "Who's there?" said the stranger.
And suddenly the voices ceased their whispering and coalesced into words.
A witness in the house of Jehovah." "Father, are you all right?" cried Simon. "Father Kavanagh, please." "Who the fuck's there?" snarled the stranger. "No one must know," hissed the voices.
Simon crouched down beside the stricken priest. He jumped at the sound of the penitent's door flying open, and he knew the stranger was coming. Pressing his face against Father Kavanagh's chest, he began to cry. But when the stranger grabbed the handle and tried to open the priest's door, Simon held it shut.
"Open this fucking door, priest," growled the stranger,
and the whispers made his intentions terrifyingly clear.
"Silence the witness, cut out his tongue, fill his mouth with dirt."
Simon knew that Father Kavanagh was dead. There was nothing he could do. He was just 8 years old, and he was utterly terrified. The stranger pulled at the door, tearing at the handle with all his animal strength, but Simon closed his eyes and held it shut. If that was all he could do, then he would do it. He would hold the door shut, keep the stranger out.
"Silence the witness, cut out his tongue, fill his mouth with dirt."
Simon sobbed against the priest's chest. He was losing his battle with the fear, and his grip on the door was failing.
Hold the door shut. Keep the stranger out.
Hey!
The shout came from the workman on top of the scaffolding, and the assault on the door came to a sudden stop. The two men began to climb quickly down the ladder, and the stranger stepped away from the door.
What the hell are you doing?
They demanded as they reached the floor, but the stranger was already heading towards the back of the church.
Stop! What have you done? Stop!
The stranger started to run, racing down one aisle while the workman gave chase down the other. Oblivious to the presence of the traumatized boy, they sprinted for the main doors and the stranger fled before them. Simon heard the men charging through the church and, trembling with fear, he pushed himself away from the body of Father Kavanagh. He opened the confessional door and peered round the church, now quiet and peaceful, as if nothing had happened. With a last tearful look at his friend and confidant, he left the confessional and crossed over to the sacristy, where there was a side door that was always unlocked. Grasping the heavy iron ring, he hauled the door open and gasped as the night air cooled the tears on his face. He was halfway through the door when he heard footsteps coming back into the church. Having lost the stranger in the dark suburban streets, the two workmen returned to discover the body of Father Kavanagh.
Christ! Said one as they opened the door of the confessional. Do you think that guy killed him?
Either that or he had a heart attack trying to hold the door shut.
Don't know how he managed that, said the other. There's no handle on this side.
The two men looked at the brass plate on the inside of the door. There was no lock, no handle, no way of holding it shut. Quiet as a ghost, Simon closed the sacristy door. He squeezed his eyes shut and rested his forehead against the cool, thick oak. He tried to tell himself that it was over, but he knew that it was not. He knew that one day he would meet the stranger again, only then there would be no escape. Struggling against the fear that had engulfed his soul, he tried to drive the stranger from his mind. But all he could see was the vast shadow of a man, and the name by which the stranger knew himself. Lucifer. Simon sank to his knees and sobbed in fearful silence. Lucifer. The stranger's name was Lucifer. Chapter 1. Tuesday, March the 1st. The present day. Missing. There is still no word on the whereabouts of the eminent psychologist Dr. Marcus Bryant, who went missing last week near his home in Sefton Park, Liverpool. Police are reluctant to link this latest incident with the murder of several other individuals over the last few years, all of whom worked in the field of mental health. Questions about the existence of a serial killer have been deemed unhelpful. Simon watched as the gravediggers leveled the soil over his mother's grave. They arranged the flowers around the headstone and placed a small posy in the center of the low mound. The foreman turned to him and touched the peak of his cap in respectful salute. Simon nodded and offered a small smile of thanks, then waited as they loaded their tools into the barrow, put on their coats, and sauntered away. The graveyard was quiet. The last of the mourners had long since taken their leave, and Simon was alone at last. It was raining slightly, and the air was filled with the loamy scent of earth. Breathing in the smell, he moved forward to stand at the foot of the grave. He let out a sigh as the expression on his face turned inwards, the grief softened by a smile of love and enduring fondness. His mother's death had come as no surprise, and yet, after 22 years of her constant presence, it was difficult to accept that she was gone. He felt the sadness welling up inside, but he also felt relief that she had not lived to see him suffer. She was down there now with his dad, together again at last. They were at peace, and he was free to do what he had to do. Wiping the tears from his eyes, his mind drifted back to the last conversation he had with his mum.
"Will you tell anyone?"
she'd asked. Simon nodded.
"Who?" "Everyone."
She smiled, but her smile was tempered with a mother's concern.
"They will fear you. I will help them understand. They will try to control you, yes," he replied. "They will try."
"And there is someone you can trust, someone who can help you?"
"Possibly, yes."
"Good, that's good."
She had closed her eyes a final time.
"Take care of yourself, my love," she breathed.
"Do what you have to do."
Simon nodded at the memory of his mother's final words. Crouching down beside the grave, he kissed his fingers and pressed them into the soft mound of earth. Then he withdrew his hand and rose to his feet. "Now," he thought, "now I can begin." He had 5 days to decide his fate, 5 days before the end. But would it be slow or would it be quick?
"Let it be quick," he thought. "Please, God, let it be quick."
He lifted his face to the sky and blinked away his tears. Then he made his way back to the path and turned in the direction of his flat. He paused. Heading that way would take him past the church, past the place where it had all begun. For a moment he wavered. He was not sure he could face it. But the church was just a building, a place of memories. Lucifer was not there. Lucifer was elsewhere. Simon took a breath and began to walk. The light was fading when he reached St. Joseph's. He stopped and turned to peer over the black iron railings, his mind leaping back to that terrible night 14 years ago. The lifeless body of Father Kavanagh, the unsettling sound of whispers, and the fury in Lucifer's voice when he realized that someone had overheard his confession. As the memories faded, Simon found that he was gripping the railings. Slowly, the tension went out of his body. He let go of the railings, and his eyes took on a more determined glint. He shook his head to clear his thoughts, then, with a final look at the church, he continued on his way. Navigating the leafy suburbs of Manchester, it took him another 20 minutes to reach his flat. He opened the front door of the converted Victorian house and climbed the stairs to a second door on the first floor. Opening it, he placed his keys on a small unit in the hall. He took off his jacket, loosened his black tie, and proceeded down the hall to his spare room. The room was almost empty, but there was a chair and a white table beside the door. On it was a pot full of pens, a sprawl of paper, and various rolls of adhesive tape. There was also a white padded envelope, a mobile phone, and a small black notebook with a thin pencil pushed down into the spine. The notebook looked old and well used. Simon picked it up and turned to the first entry. October 1997. The entry was made some 14 years ago in the scrawly hand of an 8-year-old boy. Under the date was a name, Father Kavanagh. The old priest's name was crossed out, and beneath it, Simon had written, "I'm sorry." He flicked through the pages, through the long list of crossed-out names, to a page that was divided into 6 days. In the space for today's date, there were 2 names noted down. The first was Mum. Gently, Simon crossed out the word and drew a single X beside it. The second name was Dr. Marcus Bryant. He put the tip of the pencil to the name and shook his head in a gesture of regret. Then slowly his eyes moved across the page to Thursday and another name, Dr. Patrick Denning. Finally, he reached the space marked for Sunday, just 5 days from now. Here was written a single word, the last word in his little book of death. Here he had written, "Me." For several seconds he stared at the word, as images of pain and death swam through his mind. He tried to make sense of them. He tried to see beyond them. But as he did so, he began to sweat. His hands shook, his jaw clenched, and his breathing grew ragged, until dark spots appeared in his vision, and the images were swallowed up in the black shadows of his fear. Slowly, the crippling anxiety faded, as Simon conceded to his fate. But he could not stop it. He could not change it. The end was close, but before it came, there were things he had to do. He reached across the table for the mobile phone. The world needed to know that he existed, or at least that someone like him could exist. He had 5 days in which to tell them, and it would start with a phone call. Chapter 2. International Liaison for National Security. The Blenheim Suite. MI5, London. Richard Chatham spoke into the phone as he turned to the computer on his broad walnut desk. "Thank you, Ambassador. I'm just retrieving the files now." He covered the mouthpiece with his hand and breathed a deep sigh of relief. He just succeeded in averting an international crisis, but it had taken the entire weekend and the first day of his long-awaited vacation. And his wife was not amused. The high-security network flashed up on his monitor, and he entered his password. Thermopylae, 1346. Locating the necessary files, he entered the ambassador's details, verified the digital signature, and clicked send. "That's it," he said, speaking once more into the phone. "The file should be with you now." There was a brief pause, and Chatham smiled. "Not at all, Ambassador. Thank you for being so understanding." He put down the handset and pressed the red button on the base of the phone to call his aide. A few seconds passed, and a tall young man leaned in through the door of Chatham's office.
"You've done it, then?"
"Yes, Stokes," said Chatham. "You can tell upstairs to stand down." Stokes lingered in the doorway. "Your wife phoned again," he said. "She wants to know if you plan on joining her for the rest of your holiday." Chatham rolled his eyes, but his face took on a guilty flush as his eyes flicked down to his desk and the small black-and-white photograph of his wife.
"Well, you did stand her up at lunchtime," said Stokes.
"There was an accident," said Chatham, fixing his aide with a disapproving eye.
"I know," said Stokes. "She was just upset that you didn't call."
"I lost your mobile phone, I know," said Stokes. "I told her."
"And what did she say?"
"She said that was convenient." Chatham sighed. He could not blame his wife for being annoyed. It had been 18 months since he'd last taken a holiday, and this one had been murder to arrange. With annoyance, he waved Stokes out.
"Just tell them upstairs," he said.
"Yes, sir," said Stokes. And with that, he left the room. Chatham took an exhausted breath. He was just reaching out to call his wife when a phone began to ring. And not just any phone, but the phone. He paused. Maybe he had heard wrong. Maybe it was just his desk phone that was ringing. The phone rang again, and now there was no mistaking its distinctive tone. Chatham turned to look at the old-fashioned phone that sat on the bureau in the corner of his office. In the 7 years he had held this post, that phone had rung only 5 times, and none of them was an occasion he was eager to recall. He stared at the large black phone as if it were a Pandora's box he feared to open, but the prospect of ignoring it was not an option. Only a handful of people in the world were cleared to use that line, and ignoring any one of them was absolutely unthinkable. The phone rang a third time, but still he hesitated. His wife would never forgive him if he ruined the rest of their holiday. Almost without thinking, he got up from his desk and went to stand over the bureau. The phone rang a fourth time. 4 times was tardy, 5 would be downright rude, and if the phone was left to ring 6 times, Chatham would be getting a call from his superiors. There was no doubt about it, this call was going to screw up his week,
But Richard Chatham could not abide rudeness. He picked up the phone.
"Blenheim Suite, Chatham speaking," he said, following the accepted protocol. "My apologies for ruining your holiday, Mr. Chatham."
In an instant, Chatham went from professional resignation to icy alertness. That was not a conventional reply, and the voice was not one he recognized. The accent was English, but not the Prime Minister's Eton English. This was more northerly, Manchester maybe.
"Who is this?" he demanded.
"This is not time for introductions, Mr. Chatham. I just need you to listen." The voice was self-assured, but despite that, there was a distinct note of weariness to it.
"How did you get this number?"
Chatham was playing for time, trying to collect his thoughts. He was still reeling from the fact that an unauthorized individual had managed to get access to this line. Stepping away from the bureau, he reached across his desk and began to stab at the red button on the base of his normal desk phone. "I'm sorry, Mr. Chatham. I'm not in a position to answer your questions at the moment, but I do need your attention." Chatham waited impatiently for Stokes to answer the buzzer. At the same time, he tried to glean as much detail about the caller as possible. He was male, young, early 20s. The door to Chatham's office opened and Stokes poked his head into the room.
"Sir?"
The frantic beeping of the intercom had effectively communicated the urgency of the summons. Chatham made a rapid circling motion with his finger and pointed to the handset held to his ear. He also mouthed the words,
"Trace this call."
Stokes looked down at the phone on Chatham's desk. He seemed puzzled by the fact that the handset was still in place. Chatham covered the mouthpiece of the phone he was holding.
"Not that one, you idiot. This one."
He pointed to the phone sitting on the bureau. Stokes looked at the old-fashioned phone, and comprehension finally dawned. He disappeared rapidly from the doorway, and Chatham returned his full attention to the caller on the line. "Are you still there, Mr. Chatham?" said the caller, as if he'd been waiting for Chatham to finish.
"Yes, I'm still here. Now who the hell is this? This is a restricted..."
"Please, Mr. Chatham, I do not have time to explain. Now do you have a pen and paper?" Needled at being cut off like that, Chatham grabbed a pencil from a rosewood desk tidy and flipped open his leather-bound diary. He glanced anxiously at the door to his office, wondering how Stokes was coming along with the trace. It would not be an easy task. This was a clean line, no computer screening, no automatic recording, no network and exchange software. The people who used this phone had to know that their words were treated with the utmost confidentiality.
"Go ahead," said Chatham, trying to sound calm when in truth he was deeply unsettled by this breach of security. If someone had managed to get hold of this number, then he wondered what other sensitive information they might have access to. He was about to find out.
"Please write down the following letters and numbers as I call them out," the caller directed. Chatham's pencil hovered over the page. "What kind of perverse game is this?" "T," the voice said. Chatham wrote a capital T at the top of the page. HERMOPYLAE. A chill ran down Chatham's spine as he recognized the first part of his password for accessing the classified files of the Blenheim Suite. As a student of history, Chatham had combined two famous battles to make up his password. The first was the Battle of Thermopylae from the Greco-Persian Wars. The second was the Battle of Crecy, which took place on the 26th of August 1346. 1, 3, 4, 6. The voice on the line continued. Thermopylae 1346. Chatham's password to information that could undermine the United Kingdom's relations with half the countries in the developed world. Chatham felt sick.
"Who is this?"
he asked, in a voice that was all but robbed of breath. "As I indicated, Mr. Chatham, I'm not going to tell you my name at this time. I apologize for the secrecy, but for the moment it is necessary. I have contacted you because I believe I can trust you. I hope in time you will learn to trust me. But for now, I just need you to write down the names of the following people."
Chatham's brain was buzzing with so many thoughts that he barely registered what the caller had just said.
Mr. Chatham?
Yes, said Chatham. Yes, I'm ready. Chatham's mind raced as he began to write.
Who is this? What do they want?
First of all, there's Greater Manchester's chief coroner, Sir Daniel Coombs.
Has somebody died? Asked Chatham.
Not yet, Mr. Chatham. Now, please, just note down the names. Chatham bridled at being spoken to like this, but he wrote the name down all the same. Then there's the German psychiatrist, Heinrich Dollinger.
How did he get this number? Thought Chatham. And how the hell does he know my password?
Yale's professor of neurology, Harvey Osler, the caller added. The list ran to 17 names and included scientists, doctors, military personnel, and even religious leaders from at least 13 different countries. Scanning the list, Chatham wondered what they could possibly have in common and what the caller wanted him to do with the list. Do you have them noted down? The caller asked.
Yes, replied Chatham, but I don't see how they concern me. I deal in the political arena.
Oh, you're too modest, Mr. Chatham, the caller chided. You deal in far more than that. Chatham remained silent. True, his remit was largely political, but the methods he used to achieve his ends had more in common with a spymaster from the era of the Cold War. But Chatham was not a high-profile member of the security services. He worked behind the scenes, the oil between the cogs of power. If Chatham was doing his job properly, then he should not be noticed at all.
That's as maybe, he said. But what is it you want from me? Why this list of people? Do you have information? Something that could help the British government?
Not exactly.
Then what? Said Chatham with growing exasperation. What is it you want me to do?
I want you to send them an invitation.
An invitation to what?
I'm afraid that'll have to wait for another time.
What do you mean, another time?
Said Chatham, sensing that the caller was bringing their conversation to a close.
We will speak again, Mr. Chatham,
the caller said in a tone of certainty that Chatham found far from reassuring. For now, I think your colleague has some information for you.
Wait,
said Chatham, as Stokes reappeared in the doorway. Goodbye, Mr. Chatham, and once again I am sorry for ruining your holiday. The caller hung up, and the buzz of the disconnected line was like the bewildered buzzing of Chatham's mind.
What the hell just happened? What the hell was that all about?
Slowly, Chatham lowered the handset from his ear. Then he looked up at Stokes, whose expression suggested that he'd never seen his boss this unsettled before.
What have you got?
Asked Chatham, in a voice that made his young aide shrink behind the door. Stokes hesitated.
Tell me you got something, said Chatham. The guy was on for ages. You must have got something.
Yes, we got something, said Stokes, but you're not going to like it. Richard Chatham leaned heavily on his broad walnut desk. It seemed that one crisis was over, but the next had only just begun. Someone had done the unthinkable. They had successfully breached one of the upper tiers of MI5 security. They had undermined the integrity of the Blenheim suite, and they had ensured that he would be working every hour God sent until he had some answers. He screwed up his face in frustrated anguish and glanced at the black and white photo on his desk. Of all the questions flooding through his mind, there was one that stood out more starkly than the rest.
How the hell was he going to tell his wife?
Chapter 3. Simon's hand shook as he lowered the mobile phone and pressed the button to end the call. He tried to sound calm and confident, while in truth he'd felt sick with nerves. But that was it. That was the first call, the crucial call that set everything else in motion. Now he just had to see it through, if he could. Reaching across the table, he picked up the padded envelope and dropped the mobile phone inside. He sealed the envelope and turned it over to check the address. Richard Chatham, International Liaison for National Security, the Blenheim Suite, MI5, London. He hoped that Mr. Chatham would be relieved to get his phone back, but he suspected its return would only add to the sense of futility that the poor man was undoubtedly feeling. Still, he could not suppress a wicked little smile at Chatham's bewilderment. Putting the package down, he picked up a black marker and approached the far wall of his spare room, which was covered by a mass of notes, newspaper cuttings and pictures, most of them concerning abductions and gruesome, unsolved murders. There were photographs of individuals alongside travel schedules, maps, and obscure technical blueprints. And everything was covered with interconnecting lines and arrows. It looked like the obsessive wall of a madman. Simon moved to the left-hand side of the wall, where a small piece of paper bore the words, Richard Chatham, MI5. He underlined the name and gave it a self-satisfied little tick. Only one picture lay to the left of Chatham's name, and Simon brushed the photograph of his parents lightly with his fingertips. With a sigh of exhaustion, he stepped back from the wall. What he really needed now was sleep, but he found himself hovering, his eyes drawn to a small piece of fluorescent orange paper, bearing a mobile telephone number and the name Steve Brennus. This piece of paper lay at the center of the wall with numerous lines and arrows radiating from it. Pinned to the wall beside it were a Virgin Airlines envelope and a receipt from a local florist for a bouquet of flowers and a large, stuffed Nemo. Simon continued to stare at the piece of paper, his hand aching as he gripped the marker in his fist. His heart began to pound, and beads of sweat stood out upon his brow. To acknowledge that piece of paper was to acknowledge the very worst of all his fears. "Not just now," he breathed. This deferment was enough, and the tension went out of his body. With a deep breath, he turned away from the wall. He put the marker back on the table and was about to leave the room when a sense of overwhelming fear rose up inside him. An image sprang into his mind, the image of a man standing bound and naked on the stone floor of a crudely built chapel. A dark figure loomed over him. It was the dark figure of Lucifer. Simon's face grew pale and fixed with terror. Then his head was snatched back as if someone had hit him in the face with something hard. With a choking cry, he was sent reeling back against the wall. He raised his hands as if to fend off another blow.
"No! Please, no!"
he gasped, although he was completely alone in the room. Another invisible blow smashed into the side of his knee, and with an agonizing grunt, he fell to the floor.
"Not again! Please!"
He cowered against the wall, his trembling hands still trying to shield his face. The blows had ceased, and Simon looked up, as if someone were speaking to him. He began to cry, shaking his head in hopeless denial. He knew what was coming next. His eyes grew wide with horror. Then his body convulsed in agony as a spatter of lesions appeared on his face. He screamed as the burning began.
"Yes,"
he cried.
"Yes, I confess."
But it was too late. Even now he could feel the shroud closing around his body.
"No,"
he sobbed.
No.
And then he spoke no more. His words were choked off, and his eyes began to bulge. The muscles in his face and neck strained with desperate futility, but the blackness was closing in around him, his vision shrinking down to a dark, diminishing tunnel. And then, as suddenly as it had materialized, it was gone. The pain was gone. Simon drew a shuddering breath. His entire body shook as he glanced around the room, as if trying to convince himself there was no one there. Finally, he let out a tremulous sigh and leaned back against the wall. He sat for a minute or two in shock, then rose unsteadily to his feet. With trembling fingers, he plucked the small piece of orange paper from the wall. Then, stumbling across the room, he collapsed into the chair at the table beside the door. With one hand, he wiped the tears from his face. With the other, he reached for his small black notebook. His hands shook as he turned to the page marked for today. Then he took out the thin pencil and crossed out the name of Dr. Marcus Bryant. Beneath it, he wrote, "I'm sorry." He squeezed his eyes shut as a tight knot of guilt twisted inside him. Once again, Lucifer had taken a life, and once again he had been able to stop him. He closed the notebook and stared at the small piece of orange paper. "No," he breathed, "I can't do this alone." Reaching inside his jacket, he took out his own mobile phone, and then he closed his eyes and took a few deep breaths to compose himself. When he was ready, he raised the phone and entered the number. There was no need for him to check it. He knew the number by heart. Steve Brennus stood in the front room of his parents' Welsh cottage, a mobile phone held to his ear. He dropped a beautifully prepared business plan on the coffee table and slumped into the armchair by the window, as his accountant confirmed what he already knew. He was screwed. "I'm sorry, Steve, but they've already extended the deadline twice. Unless you can come up with £12,000 by next Thursday, the bank will take possession of the house." Steve put a hand to his head. "I still can't believe it's all gone," said his accountant after a pause. £300,000 is an awful lot to lose in one night." Steve snorted bitterly. "Apparently Christine's brother has a gift for losing money." "Have you spoken to her?" "No, not since she phoned from the hospital." There was an awkward silence. "They'll want you back," said his accountant. "They just need a bit of time." "Sure," said Steve. "You should call her." "No, she'll call me when she's ready." Another uncomfortable pause. "Listen, Steve," began his accountant. "Jenny and I have got more shares. We could easily..." "No, Mike." "Really?" said Steve. "You've already done more than enough." "Don't worry about that. Things will work themselves out. You'll see." Steve couldn't bring himself to answer. "I have to go," he said. "Okay, you take care of yourself, and call me if you need anything." Steve ended the call and put his phone down on the coffee table. Looking through the rain-streaked window, he gazed at the vast, dim shapes of the Welsh mountains. Even on a dismal evening like this, they managed to look glorious, indomitable, like the Welsh spirit, his mate Paddy would have said. He glanced at a photograph on the mantelpiece, 5 hard-faced young men in combat fatigues, sitting together on a sand-coloured Landover. Their uniforms bore no sign of the SAS regiment in which they'd served, but Christine had cut out a picture of the famous winged dagger and stuck it in the corner of the frame. Steve shook his head, a nostalgic smile creeping onto his face. Grabbing a bottle of water from the coffee table, he went to stand before the mantelpiece. At the center was a picture of Steve, with an attractive woman and a beautiful young girl. His smile broadened, but then his eyes closed and his face contorted with a frown of regret. "What a fucking mess," he said softly to himself. Shaking his head, he took a mouthful of water and placed the bottle on the mantelpiece. Then he went to get the rest of his things from the car. The rain was getting heavier, so he grabbed his father's wax cotton jacket from the peg in the hall. His father had been every bit as tall as Steve, although not as solidly built. The jacket felt tight, but Steve liked to wear it when he came to the cottage. He found the smell comforting. In the living room, Steve's mobile phone began to ring. "Christine," he breathed, and some of the weight seemed to lift from his face as he dashed back into the front room of the cottage. His heart was suddenly racing, but his face fell as he picked up the phone. There was no sign of Christine's name on the phone screen, and he did not recognize the caller's number.
With a heavy sigh, he pressed the button to accept the call.
Hello? Hello, Mr. Brennus. The caller sounded shaken up, and for a moment Steve thought it was Christine's brother, Paul, calling to apologize for ruining his life. But no, this guy sounded younger.
Who's this?
Said Steve, as he shrugged himself into the waxed cotton jacket. My name is Simon, and I'd like to employ your services.
As what?
Asked Steve, becoming suddenly wary. Simon paused.
As a chaperone, I suppose you might say.
You mean bodyguard? Said Steve with annoyance. You want a bodyguard?
In a sense, yes.
I'm not in the security business anymore. Haven't been for years. Besides, I'm not really trained for personal protection. If you need a specialist, I can...
I don't need an expert, said Simon. I need you.
Thanks a lot, thought Steve. His thumb twitched to end the call, but he was curious to know how this guy had got hold of his number.
Who put you on to me? He said. How did you get this number?
That's not important, said Simon. What's important is that I need your help and you need mine. Steve's attention was now fully engaged.
In what way can you help me?
I will pay you £3,000 a day for 5 days' employment plus expenses, said Simon. Steve's eyebrows lifted in surprise. £15,000 was enough to prevent the bank foreclosing on the house. However, going back into the field of personal security held no appeal for him, and Christine would never approve.
Not interested, he said.
Are you sure? Said Simon. £15,000. Money isn't everything?
No, but the love of a wife and daughter is.
What the hell do you know about my wife and daughter?
I know that you didn't mean to hurt her, said Simon, and that they will miss you when you don't come home.
Steve spun round in the small living room of the cottage. He was suddenly anxious, confused, and furious. Was this guy threatening him? He said he wanted to help. What the hell was going on?
Mr. Brennus, said Simon, I have no desire to add to your troubles. I wouldn't be calling you at all if I didn't think it was necessary.
He paused, allowing Steve to absorb what he was saying. But I really do need your help, and I'm not trying to intimidate you either. I really can help sort things out with your wife and your little girl.
How do you know about this? Said Steve. No one knows about this. Are you a friend of Paul's? Did he put you up to this?
Steve knew he was ranting, and he hated the sense of being in the dark, of feeling so unnerved.
No one's put me up to this, Mr. Brennus, said Simon.
I'll explain in more detail when we meet.
Steve gave a hollow laugh.
And what makes you think I'm willing to meet you? He was suddenly calm and more annoyed than ever.
You'll agree to meet me, because you will want to know what I know.
And, said Simon, you really could do with the money. There was a long and deeply uncomfortable silence, in which Steve tried to think of any way he could possibly ignore this strange and infuriating guy on the other end of the telephone. After almost a minute, he knew there was not.
Where? He said. When?
Simon put down the phone and breathed a sigh of relief. There, he'd done it. He'd made the call, faced his fear. It was the fear that made him uncertain. It was the fear that clouded his view. For all his insight, the fear was like a black shadow that engulfed his mind. There were gaps in the shadow and glimpses of what might lie beyond, but the gaps were filled with pain, and what lay beyond seemed insubstantial. More like wishful thinking than concrete reality. He drew his hands over his face. The trauma of the mysterious attack was still evident in his trembling limbs, but that was not the first time he'd experienced violence like that, and he knew with sickening certainty that it would not be the last. However, the growing intensity of the attacks was almost more than he could bear. But bear it he must, for the next 5 days at least. One way or another, that would decide it. Decide the manner of his death, that is. Simon rose from the chair and limped through to the bathroom to examine his face in the mirror. His left eye was badly swollen, with a livid red mark across his temple. The spattering of pockmarks was still intensely painful, but even now they were beginning to fade. A wave of exhaustion swept over him, and he leant heavily on the hand basin. He had to remain strong. He had to remain focused. It had taken many months to plan the next 5 days. He could not lose it now. He was frightened and tired and needed to get some sleep, because tomorrow he was going to meet Steve Brennus. Steve Brennus, the man he hoped would kill him. Chapter 4. Lucifer was satisfied. Lucifer was sated. One less voice of heresy in a world of lies. Dressed in the filthy cassock and cotter of an altar server, Lucifer gazed at the inverted crucifix that hung, battered and splintered, from the bare stone walls of his chapel. He was filled with the glory of the chorus, but slowly the ecstasy lifted from his mind. He looked at the body of the heretic lying at his feet, the broken face, the shattered knee, the smoking flesh. He bent down, removed the hose from the shroud, and sealed it with a plastic tie, before lifting the body from the slick and sticky paving stones. Soft hues from the stained glass window fell across his massive form, as, with apparent ease, he raised the man's grotesquely wrapped corpse high above the altar. The sleeves of his cassock fell back to reveal powerful arms, covered with a hatchwork of scars and the lines of scripture crudely tattooed or burned into the skin. With something closer to control than care, Lucifer laid the limp body on the altar. He pinched out the thick tallow candles and stepped back from the great slab of marble. He genuflected in the aisle, between the short rows of crudely made pews. Then he rose from his knee, crossed himself, and retired. Chapter 5. Wednesday, March the 2nd. Torture. Police have refused to confirm that the body of a man found earlier this morning on the outskirts of Liverpool is that of the missing psychologist, Dr. Marcus Bryant. They have also refused to comment on the cause of death or the nature of Dr. Bryant's injuries, although witnesses at the scene have reported signs of apparent torture. Steve Brennus picked his way up the wooded hillside of Alderley Edge. He knew the edge well and had been surprised that his mysterious caller had chosen this particular location for their meeting. The path leveled out, and Steve paused beside a sandstone outcrop at the foot of which was a shallow stone basin filled with water. Above the basin, an inscription had been carved into the rock, now weather-worn and barely visible, but Steve knew what it said. Drink of this and take thy fill, for the water falls by the wizard's will. Above the words, one could just make out the image of a wizard's face. Steve smiled as he continued along the woodland path. He had always loved the legend of Alderley Edge. 100 enchanted knights lying beneath the hollow hill, sleeping in wizard-induced slumber. And beside each knight, a milk-white steed. 100 knights ready to ride out and defeat evil in the hour of Britain's greatest need. Steve had spent endless days as a child, exploring the rocks and caves of the edge, searching for the secret gates beyond which the knights were said to lie. He and Christine had brought Sally here. They had raced down the forest tracks, stopping at every rock face to rap on it with their staffs, to see if the golden gates of magic would appear. They never did, of course, but the magic was not diminished. A spasm of regret gripped Steve's chest at the thought of his wife and daughter. Waking without them had been the most miserable experience, but he did not know how to fix what he had done, and he would not go back until he did. With an effort, he pushed them from the forefront of his mind and brought his attention back to the reason why he was here. Stormy Point, 5 o'clock, the man called Simon had said. Stormy Point was a famous prominence on the edge, where a jumble of sandstone boulders forged an opening in the forested slopes to reveal the wide expanse of the Cheshire Plain. Another half mile saw Steve drawing close to the agreed meeting place. Following his military training, He left the path and circled round through the undergrowth to come at the point from the opposite direction. If this guy was actually there, he wanted to get a good look at him before he made his presence known. Moving slowly now, he scrambled up a bank, and, using a stunted holly bush for cover, he peered out through a cleft in the rocks. A young man sat on the rocks, some 50 yards away, staring out across the plain, a mobile phone held to his ear. Dressed in jeans, light walking boots, and a brown corduroy jacket, he looked too normal to be Steve's mystery caller, too pleasant. Cautiously, Steve shifted his position to see if there was anyone else there. Nope, no one. He glanced down at his watch, 5 o'clock dead. Steve